This is Where Did the Road Go? Our aim is to explore the fringe, to be true skeptics and question openly, to investigate the paranormal, bring light to the dark corners of history, and give a voice to the shunned of science. We deal in mystery and the important questions that these subjects bring to light. What is reality? Who are we? And why are we here? Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com for a full show archive, links to all our social media, upcoming schedule, and much, much more. Now, join your host Soraya on this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
Welcome to this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go? This week, we're going to be airing part two of our interview with Dr. Rick Strassman. His new book is called DMT and the Soul of Prophecy, and it's very different from the first book. The subtitle is A New Science of Spiritual Revelation in the Hebrew Bible. I think it's a fascinating piece of work and very unique. This is not something that's ever been investigated before, so I suggest approaching it with an open mind. He may very well be onto something here. And so, we're just going to get right into this interview, and I hope you find it interesting. All right, and we're back with Dr. Rick Strassman, and your new book is DMT and the Soul of Prophecy, A New Science of Spiritual Revelation in the Hebrew Bible. And how many years is this in the making, Rick?
Well, I started studying the Bible around the time my Zen community and I parted ways, which was 96. And then the whole concept of the prophetic state began, you know, dawning on me about a year or two after that. So I began, taking notes for the project around 97, you know, 98. So the book came out September last year, 2014. So, you know, a 15, 16-year project.
Damn. And you were raised Jewish, am I correct?
Yeah, I was raised, you know, Jewish, had a bar mitzvah, you know, learned, some modern Hebrew. I studied the Bible a bit, you know, the first, you know, five books of the Bible called the Torah. But it was, you know, mostly, you know, cultural and, you know, historical, as opposed to especially a spiritual approach to Judaism. And, you know, then I kind of, took this long, you know, detour through Zen Buddhism for over 20 years. And then at a certain point, returned to my roots and started looking at the Bible.
And what did the Zen community have a problem with regarding your DMT research?
Well, you know, there were a number of, you know, good things about my involvement with, you know, Zen study and practice over all those years. It influenced, you know, the performance of my study to a large extent. I had spent a, you know, summer, you know, learning, you know, Buddhist, you know, psychology with a Tibetan, you know, Buddhist as an elective in medical school in the 70s. And as a result of, you know, that experience, I began, you know, developing the rating scale for the DMT response, you know, which I, which I developed and which has been used, for other, you know, drug studies around the world over the last, you know, 10, 15 years. So it also influenced, you know, like how, we supervised the drug sessions. I would enter into a, you know, light, you know, meditative state, to both, you know, be responsive, you know, to the volunteer and the volunteer's needs, as well as, staying responsive, you know, to my own inner, you know, reactions, you know, to what was going on in the room and within myself. And it also was important over the years, you know, to discuss my interest in, you know, the psychedelic state with the Buddhist community. The vast majority of the young monks that I had met and kind of, you know, grown up with over the years had got their first flash of the possibility of an enlightened state of mind on LSD in their, you know, teenage or early 20s, You know, so, you know, off and on over the years, I had, you know, been discussing, you know, my interest with them, and, you know, got, you know, quite a lot of support for, you know, thinking about, speculating about, you know, the relationship, you know, between the psychedelic state and the meditative state and a meditative way of life. You know, so, you know, from the spiritual point of view, from the academic point of view, from the personal point of view, you know, from, you know, the professional, you know, perspective, you know, Zen was quite helpful. You know, but as, you know, time went on, and, when the rubber hit the road, as it were, and I actually began my studies and then started writing about them, you know, that was a little, you know, too much, you know, for the orthodoxy, as it were, and the community, you know, needed to, you know, distance itself from any, you know, possible, you know, like association between, you know, Buddhist practice and drugs. So, so at a certain point, you know, the politics, you know, kind of got in the way, you know, but also, you know, also the data, you know, kind of got in the way at the same time, you know, because I was expecting an enlightenment, you know, like experience, you know, formless, unitive, white light, you know, merging with, you know, the source of being, you know, no personality, you know, no thoughts, no images, you know, no feelings, no body, those kinds of experiences, as a result of the high, you know, dose of DMT. You know, but on the contrary, it was quite interactive. It was as opposite, you know, to the enlightenment experience as one could imagine. And also, you know, the Buddhist, you know, model, you know, looks at the visions as unreal. You know, that they're just, you know, kind of, you know, the brain or the mind, you know, kind of, you know, letting loose, flotsam and, you know, jetsam, you know, on its way, you know, towards the, you know, formless enlightened state. You know, so it was kind of a, you know, conflict, you know, to regard my volunteers' reports through a Buddhist, you know, lens because of their positing, you know, the reality of what they had just undergone, you know, versus, you know, the Buddhist model, which would posit, you know, the basic unreality of what, you know, they had just undergone.
Right, right, okay. And you also looked at shamanism as a possible model to explain DMT as well.
Right. You know, I don't have that much experience with, you know, the shamanic model, but, you know, some, and I've studied it, you know, some, and I've, you know, discussed it with practitioners and scholars. You know, one of the advantages of, you know, shamanism, especially the Latin American ayahuasca kind of, you know, shamanism that's making inroads into the West, is, you know, their belief in, you know, the reality of the spiritual, in the spiritual world, it, you know, that it exists, you know, parallel, ongoing, you know, to, you know, this, you know, world of everyday consensus reality. But at the same time, they only look at the spirits. It's kind of a, you know, it's more, you know, focused on the spirits and of the plants, the spirits of the ancestors, as opposed, you know, to a more, God-oriented, you know, kind of model. And I think any, you know, model that's going to be getting any, you know, traction in the West, you know, needs to be, you know, consistent with, you know, with, you know, most people's beliefs. And if it's an atheistic, you know, kind of model, I don't think it would be able to be as influential as, you know, one that, you know, took into account, you know, the presence, the activities, you know, the attributes of God. Especially if you're going to be, you know, speaking about this, you know, the, you know, the potential, spiritual benefits of, you know, taking these drugs.
So with this book, you're not, I mean, you're not coming out here and preaching religion. You're showing the connection between the DMT state and the prophetic state in the Hebrew Bible, and suggesting that this could be used as a model for what's happening in the DMT state.
Right. Yeah, you know, so I, you know, looked at, you know, the Zen approach, you know, to the DMT effect. I looked at, you know, there's, and I also, you know, looked at, you know, the shamanic approach. And, you know, they both, you know, kind of had shortcomings. You know, another, you know, shortcoming of, you know, the shamanic model, at least, you know, the version which is, you know, coming in to the West, is it seems, you know, somewhat ethically and, you know, somewhat, you know, morally, you know, challenged, as it were. You know, there's a lot of spiritual warfare, black magic, revenge, you know, killing each other. You know, there's murders of, you know, shamans, you know, happening quite frequently in the Amazon. You know, rival shamans are killing each other. And, you know, clearly, you know, the Western religions have their own, you know, set of, you know, violence, prone individuals and policies and whatnot. But you would expect anyway, you know, that an alternative model would at least, you know, be an improvement, or wouldn't be, you know, any worse, you know, than, you know, the extant, you know, religious, well, you know, the extant religious models, you know, which are current. Yeah, you know, so I started looking at the Hebrew Bible, and I started to think about the notion of the prophetic state. And I think it's important to, you know, define how I use the word prophetic or, you know, prophecy as compared, yeah, you know, to the usual use of the term. You know, most people think of, you know, prophecy as predicting or foretelling, you know. Yeah, but that is, you know, more of an artifact of how the Greeks translated the Hebrew word for prophet when they translated the Hebrew Bible into Greek, which was the first, you know, non-Hebrew language into which, you know, the Bible was translated. So the Hebrew word for prophet is Navi, N-A-V-I, and the Greeks translated that as prophetes. And you know, so the Hebrew, you know, root of Navi means to communicate or to interpret or to be a channel. It could also be translated as, you know, to bubble up, or even to be high, you know, like, you know, kind of elevated high, you know, not intoxicated high, but, you know, like at a higher station. You know, but the Greeks were interested in, you know, divination, you know, as their main, you know, goal of entering into altered states, you know, divination or foretelling. And the word, and the Greek word prophetes means to speak before, in other words, to speak before something's happening. You know, so it's, you know, kind of an artifact of, you know, the Greek, you know, fascination, you know, with, you know, foretelling the future, which ended up with the translation of Navi, which, you know, more means like an interpreter or a you know, communicator from the spiritual, you know, world or from God, as opposed to foretelling. You know, so I, you know, define the prophetic state as any spiritual experience as encountered by any figure in the Hebrew Bible. You know, so like any inspiration, any out-of-body experiences, any visions or any voices of God or God's angels, you know, foretelling can occur in the prophetic state. You know, it isn't a, you know, necessary, you know, criterion, though. And you can predict without, you know, the prophetic experience, you know, like weathermen, you know, predict, you know, the weather with a, you know, fair amount of accuracy, but that isn't a, you know, prophetic state.
I don't know, I think some people would argue how accurate the weatherman usually is.
Right. But you know, they're right, you know, more times than not anyway.
So prophecy then is, in a sense, it's that communication state with something else.
Yeah, it usually is a communication, but at the very least, it's an interaction. You know, so the interaction, you know, could be for the purpose of communication. Not necessarily, you know, but obviously the most, enduring quality of the prophetic experience is, you know, the prophetic message, which is, you know, communicated in the prophetic state.
Now, when you did the DMT research, none of their experiences were of the level of the Old Testament prophets.
I started off, you know, comparing the phenomenology of the two states, the visions and the voices, the emotions, you know, the bodily sensations, you know, the effect on thinking, you know, the effect on will or, you know, volition. And if you look at, side-by-side comparison of descriptions of my, you know, volunteers' effects and the descriptions of, you know, the phenomenology of the prophetic, you know, figures in the text, they're quite, you know, similar. There's a huge amount of overlap. You know, I would say 85-90%. But still, when you stand back a bit and you look at the impact of the prophetic experience as articulated in the Bible, and you look at the impact of the volunteers' experiences, they clearly aren't as enduring or as impactful or as profound or influential. You know, so that got me back to the drawing board in, you know, some ways. It began with my, you know, thinking about, one of the phenomenological, you know, properties of the two states. And, you know, that was a new category which I called relatedness. And it would, you know, kind of, you know, tap the interactions between the volunteer or the prophet and, you know, the contents of their visions. And the main, you know, function of the interaction in the Bible is to communicate information. In the case of the DMT, you know, volunteers, you know, there wasn't an especially large amount of information, especially, you know, verbal information, which got communicated, you know, to them in that state. You know, so then I started looking at, you know, the information, content, especially the verbal information content of the DMT and the prophetic experience. And, you know, that's, you know, where the, you know, prophetic state obviously stands, you know, hand and shoulders or, you know, head and shoulders above, you know, the DMT experience. And, you know, up until now anyway, you know, the psychedelic experience in our culture in general.
Okay. How much do you think the cultural differences between that time period and now are shaping these experiences?
I think to a large extent, and, you know, if you look at the personality, perhaps it was like a, you know, miniature, you know, version of culture, I think it would influence the interpretation of one's encounter with spiritual realities, but I think it also bespeaks or would influence, you know, people's, you know, training and their thinking and, you know, their beliefs. One of the jobs in my new book is the development of a model of the prophetic state, using the lens of both the existence of DMT and, you know, that of the medieval Jewish, you know, commentators and, you know, philosophers, you know, who looked at the Bible and, you know, developed a, you know, metaphysics of the prophetic experience. And, so those scholars, you know, divided the well, they divided the mind into the imagination and the intellect. And the imagination is the part of the mind which, you know, contains, you know, the visions and the voices and the feelings, the emotions. The intellect is the part of the mind that extracts information, you know, from those visions and those voices. During the, you know, time of the events of the Hebrew Bible and of their being recorded and written down, you know, the mind, you know, set of those individuals was developed, it was, you know, primed, it was expecting those, you know, kinds of experiences, you know, so, you know, when they took place, you know, the intellect of those individuals, you know, could ask, you know, sophisticated questions, you know what to ask, you know how to understand the answers, you know, that were given to them. You know, one of the interesting aspects of the DMT experience, you know, was a problem in communication. You know, sometimes, you know, the volunteer would come back and say, you know, we just didn't speak the same language, or I was so afraid and so freaked out by encountering these beings, you know, that my level of anxiety precluded, you know, good communication, or, you know, the speech was, you know, garbled and I couldn't quite make out what the voice, you know, was telling me. You know, so, you know, that isn't especially, you know, common in the prophetic state, or if it is encountered, it usually takes place in the first experience or two, and after that, you know, communication becomes a lot more, you know, comfortable. You know, I'm a lot, you know, more clear and effective. You know, so the intellectual, you know, preparation, you know, foundation, as it were, of, you know, those entering into the prophetic state, as described in the Bible, you know, was an order of, you know, magnitude, you know, different, you know, than that which was the case in the DMT volunteers.
And you're also positing that these ancient people were not taking any form of hallucinogen. It was internal. It was natural.
Yeah, you know, there are a few theories out there of, you know, those experiencing the prophetic state, you know, taking plants or drugs, whatnot. You know, some people have, you know, proposed cannabis. Others have, you know, are you know, proposing, you know, DMT and the acacia plant, you know, that was burning, you know, that, you know, Moses witnessed. You know, some people think about an ergot alkaloid like LSD in the mana. You know, but I think, you know, that, well, you know, the existence of naturally occurring DMT, you know, kind of militates against, you know, looking under every shrub or every, you know, rock, you know, for some kind of psychedelic plant or substance. You can speculate that, you know, to the extent, you know, that the prophetic state, you know, phenomenology is comparable to which, you know, well, to that which occurs after an injection of DMT, you know, that there is, you know, some, you know, common, you know, biological denominator. And, yeah, you know, so I am speculating, and obviously this is extreme speculation, is, you know, that the concentrations in the minds or in the brains of the, of, you know, people experiencing a prophecy in the Old Testament were increasing naturally, increased amounts of DMT occurring naturally.
Do you also think that it has something to do with, beyond the prophetic elements, with Jewish mysticism and the mystical experiences that rabbis have?
The mystical experience that what? I didn't hear that last part.
The mystical experiences that rabbis have?
Well, the mystical experience, you know, the unitive, you know, mystical state, which I distinguish from the interactive relational one,
okay,
isn't really described in the Hebrew Bible. You know, there's, you know, one, you know, reference to, you know, Moses entering into a cloud on top of Mount Sinai. you know, but other than that, that's, you know, like one, you know, single verse out of, you know, the entire text of, you know, potentially, you know, Moses enters into a cloud. You know, but everything else is interactive. There's speaking, there's talking, there's arguing, there's being protected, there's being harmed, there's being informed, there's predictions, you know, there's teachings, you know, there's law, there's wisdom. Yeah, you know, so the Kabbalah and, you know, the rabbis, you know, who developed, you know, the Kabbalah were interested in, you know, kind of, you know, merging with God, you know, like a mystical experience in which, you know, case, you know, the personality of the experience is obliterated in a, you know, union, you know, with God. And, well, and oftentimes an ecstatic union with God.
Right.
And if you look at, you know, the Hebrew Bible, you know, prophecy is anything but ecstatic. You know, the lowest, you know, level of, you know, prophecy is, you know, is inspiration. And inspiration is what influenced, you know, David, you know, who composed the Psalms. And, you know, the Psalms, you know, are the only, you know, consistent, you know, part of the text which, you know, describes ecstasy or joy, or, you know, like, you know, blissful experience. You know, so that's kind of, you know, that's, you know, kind of, you know, low down on the, you know, rung of the, you know, prophetic ladder. You know, the rest of those people experiencing a prophetic state, you know, it's intense, it's anxiety-provoking, you know, lots of, you know, prophets, you know, don't like being prophets, they're not, you know, seeking it in particular. You know, the message can be kind of gloomy, and as a result, it can be depressing, you know, for the, you know, for the prophet. You know, so, you know, most of the, you know, figures in the Hebrew Bible, especially at the beginning of their, you know, prophetic, you know, mission, it, you know, comes on in an un, you know, bidden kind of way, that, you know, they really don't, you know, want to become, you know, imbued with, you know, the prophetic spirit, as opposed to Kabbalah, you know, where, you know, people are, you know, doing specific exercises with the specific intent of
right.
attaining a unitive mystical state.
Do you think that there could be, I want to say a natural cause, but like, for instance, earth energy or cosmic energy that hits people and increases a production of DMT?
Well, that could be, you know, you know, clearly, with respect, you know, to the prophetic state, you know, there's a, you know, great emphasis on the land of Israel.
Right.
You know, and, you know, some of the, you know, medievalists, would, you know, teach, you know, that, you know, that you can only experience, you know, the prophetic state in Israel, you know, because of, you know, the nature of the land. And specifically, you know, Jerusalem, and specifically the temple, and specifically the Holy of Holies in the temple. You know, so there seems to be a specific, you know, kind of a, you know, a specific influence of the land, you know, and, you know, you know, the geography, which, you know, seems to play a, you know, some, you know, role in the experience of prophecy.
Okay. And I would think the prophetic state is probably less like the DMT states you did in the lab, in nature, and more like maybe a UFO contactee experience where there's actual communication going on, where they're able to communicate, there's interaction, so on and so forth. And it seems real to them, just like the state of prophecy did to the people back then.
Yeah, well, you know, there are, you know, well, there are a number of, you know, features which, you know, do overlap between the prophetic, the DMT state, and, you know, the abduction experience as well. And, you know, one of them is the strong, you know, feeling of reality, or it's even more real than real. You know, when you're reading, you know, the Hebrew Bible, you know, everything else is swept aside when, you know, somebody enters into prophecy. the transition is a bit more seamless, than occurs in a lab when you're giving a drug.
Right.
But still, there isn't any question that it is taking place. Like in the beginning of a few of the prophetic, figures, mission, they were uncertain. Like Moses when he encountered the burning bush as, his initial theophany, wasn't quite, sure what was going on. He looked at the bush and it wasn't being consumed. And he said, it's burning, but it's not being consumed. What's going on? And in the case of, Joshua, when he, crossed in, into Canaan, he encountered a being, carrying a sword, and he said, are you with us or against us? He really didn't, know what was going on. He was confused, is this a real person? If it's a real person, is he, like an ally or, like an enemy? And, some of, the lower developed or, the non, canonical prophets, or, individuals, that experience, the prophetic state, aren't quite certain if it's a person or an angel, like the, mother and the father,
right.
Samson, were confused, when, they experienced a, prophetic state. They asked the angel's name, they wanted him to eat, they wanted him to, to stay with them. And, at a certain point, the being said, I don't eat and I, have no name. And if you want to offer me some food, offer it to God. So they offered it, to this, so they offered it to God and, the angel, then, went up to heaven in the fire, so it can be confusing, in the first few prophetic encounters, kind of like would occur in the DMT volunteers. They weren't quite, they weren't quite, certain what was going on. They had to get their bearings, and then after a while, it became, quite clear that it wasn't a dream, wasn't a hallucination. They were actually in some, kind of. Some kind of, they were in, some kind of, newly revealed world.
How do you define God in this book?
I began thinking about, God within a Buddhist, context, because, that was kind of my, baseline for a spiritual, system. And you can't escape, the mention of God in the Hebrew Bible. The first, sentence in the first book of the Bible, Genesis, is, God created the heavens and the earth. So who is God? So you're confronted with the notion of you're confronted with, the notion of, God early on. And I think for a lot of people who read the Bible, and probably a lot of people who open up my new book, find that the notion of God is a great stumbling block because of their, in a way, kindergarten view of the idea. They were exposed to it as children. They didn't learn anything about it afterwards. And, then as adults, they couldn't understand, how their view of God, which was attained as children, could make sense. So I was in the same boat in a lot of ways. But I also knew that if I was going to make any headway at all in the text, I needed to contend with the idea of God. So I kind of, went back to my, Buddhist roots, as it were, and started thinking about, some of, the God-like, things, or, or specific answers to specific, questions that weren't answered adequately for me in Buddhism. One of the main, tenets of, Buddhism is the idea of, cause and effect, or of karma. And, you know, cause and effect states that everything is, you know, now because of how things were before. And, you know, things in the future will be as a result of, you know, how things are now. You know, so, you know, like, I'm curious, and I was thinking, well, you know, was there, you know, like a beginning of cause and effect? And the, you know, teaching of, you know, cause and effect is everything begins and exists and it ends. That's, you know, kind of one of the, you know, basic features of karma. But at the same time, I was taught that, you know, cause and effect itself, you know, was eternal, you know, that it had no beginning and it had no ending, which, you know, didn't make sense. So then I started thinking, well, you know, there must have, you know, been a, you know, beginning of cause and effect. And, you know, so that was kind of a toehold, you know, for me to start, you know, thinking about God, like, you know, perhaps, you know, cause and effect, you know, was created by God. And, you know, cause and effect, you know, what maintains it? You know, why is, you know, cause and effect, you know, continuing even today? And I thought, well, perhaps it is, you know, God that, you know, both created and sustains, you know, cause and effect. You know, so that was, you know, one of my toeholds. And so another one of them, you know, it, you know, concerned, you know, why, you know, cause and effect, you know, seems to encourage certain things and, you know, seems to discourage other things. You know, like, you know, for example, cause and effect is a certain way. You know, for example, if you... are in a, if you're angry at, you know, somebody, it upsets your stomach, as opposed to if you're angry with, you know, somebody, you turn into a refrigerator. You know, you could explain, you know, the mechanism, you know, by which you did, you know, turn into a refrigerator after you became angry. You know, you could look at the physics and the chemistry, and you could explain it. You know, but it is the case, if you're angry, it upsets your stomach. In other words, you know, there's a certain quality of, you know, cause and effect, which, you know, is, you know, kind of designed to discourage anger. You know, so I began, you know, thinking about the moral and the ethical, you know, flavor of cause and effect, as it were. And, you know, that helped me start to, you know, think about, you know, God in a more clear, you know, kind of a, you know, manner. Well, you know, so the medievalists, you know, speak about, you know, nature, you know, the natural law and the moral law coming from the same source. You know, so if you look at, you know, cause and effect in the natural world, it's only like a, you know, physical manifestation of, you know, cause and effect in the moral or the spiritual, you know, world. And, you know, if you look at the life of Abraham, which I've been looking at quite carefully the last couple of years, you know, like, you know, Abraham was the first, you know, Jew, you know, and at the same time, you know, he lived without a written law, because he lived before Moses, you know, you know, from whom the law, you know, was transmitted. You know, so, you know, people talk about Abraham, you know, following the natural law. In other words, you know, he was able to deduce from observing nature certain ethical and, you know, moral, you know, principles, you know, because they, you know, because they both emanated, you know, from the same source, you know, that being God.
Okay. Now, when you sat down to compare these two states, how did you lay that out?
Well, I first, you know, began with, you know, the phenomenology, you know, using the categories I had developed from my DMT research. And, you know, the comparison was quite striking, quite strong. But, you know, there are, but there are clearly differences between the two states. And I began by, you know, developing that category of relatedness, which then started to, you know, weigh the prophetic state, you know, more in your favor, in, you know, terms of its complexity and its, you know, depth. You know, so, you know, when I then, you know, began to look at, you know, the message, you know, content of the two states, I kind of, you know, reversed the order and I, developed, categories, from the Bible, and, then would, look at the reports of my DMT volunteers and place, them into the categories that I had developed from, looking at the Bible in terms of the message content. So the message content, is the message of the Hebrew Bible. And, the two, and well, the two, primary, teachings is are the one God, and the golden rule. In other words, it's how you relate to the spiritual world, and well as how you relate to each other. So everything else is a derivative of those two basic foundational ideas. So. there is quite a bit stated in the Bible about God's characteristics and his activities. So like God is kind, or God is zealous, or is aware, or is timeless, those kinds of things. And if there were, and going through my DMT reports, if I found any descriptions of a spiritual entity as being sharing any of those characteristics which the Bible uses in describing God, I would bend those into those new categories. So there's ethical laws, and there's wisdom, like Proverbs and Ecclesiastes and Job. There's ethical empathy, teachings which occur in the text, which would, crop up occasionally in my report, in the reports of the volunteers.
Okay. Now, one of the things you deal with in the book is the concept of the end of prophecy. Now, was there a point where people weren't having these experiences anymore, or were they just not accepted?
Yeah, I think it's, more the case, that the latter, was true. I think, that the rabbis, declared an end, to prophecy at a certain, historical, juncture. And, that, corresponded, to the Roman occupation of, the Roman occupation of Israel at the time. One of the functions of the prophetic figure is to confront authority and to be a rabble rouser, and that was okay. So that was okay. More or less. At the time of the Hebrew monarchy, but it could be positively dangerous if you're in an occupied territory, So for the Hebrews to be talking about overthrowing a government, kind of rising up against the Roman emperor, that was dangerous, So the rabbis, in some ways, would then kind of rebrand the prophetic figures of their time. In the context of not being divinely inspired, but being idiosyncratic, or being political figures, and also I think it coincided at around the time of the beginning of Christianity. It was, I think, in some ways it was intended to exclude the divine, or the divine message out of Jesus. Which was occurring at around that time as well. If the rabbis, could kind of, disassociate, Jesus, from the, from the prophetic stream, it, was easier, to, disassociate, Christianity from Judaism.
Right. Right. Okay. Did you have anything, Luke?
No, this is just very interesting to talk about.
Okay. You also mentioned the difference between true and false prophecy.
Yeah. Well, that's a huge issue, and I think it comes back to even the prophetic, or, you know, the psychedelic state, the contemporary psychedelic state. You know, like, how do you, know, that the state you're encountering is true, or it's just increasing your own, delusion, or you're using it, for your own aggrandizement, for power, for influence, for fame, those kinds of things. So there were a number of criteria which were, developed in the Hebrew Bible and the Middle Ages, which were used to distinguish between false prophecy and true, prophecy. But even those criteria were kind of fluid and kind of dynamic and inconsistently applied. I think ultimately the main criterion which came down being used was, was whether or not, the teaching and the life of the person claiming prophetic inspiration was consistent, with the Hebrew Bible's, morality and ethos. So if you were, claiming prophecy, but you were, and at the same time you were, charging lots of money, to give your prophetic utterances, that would be inconsistent. If you were encouraging, people to worship idols as opposed to worshiping the one God, that could be an indication of a false prophet as opposed to a true one. If what you're, talking about is primarily intended to, influence people and make you rich and have sex with women or men or whatever, that would be a distinguishing, mark of a potential, false prophet. So you would expect them to be living a life and promulgating teachings which, were consistent with the text and, the commentaries which would extract, the teachings from the text.
Okay. How do you feel that this information, this sort of layout with the idea of prophecy in the Hebrew Bible, how do you think this should affect future study of DMT?
Well, I think it can influence a number of, fields of human endeavor, both religion and of science. Within, the scientific model, there's a couple of things it could do. One is the specific kind of state which is being studied and, held out as the ultimate, psychedelic state in clinical spirituality research. There are current studies which are, causing or, which are interested in occasioning, mystical experiences and, research, subjects. The gold standard for those studies is the unitive mystical state, as opposed to the interactive relational one, which is, the more prophetic one.
Right.
And in the unitive, mystical state, it's nonverbal. You can kind of come back and, talk about being one and being, one with everything, and everything is love, and you can kind of make it up as you go along. But in the prophetic state, you're kind of, saddled with, the message that's imparted in the communication. So in lots of ways, I can understand, that, the mystical, unitive, nonverbal state would be, more, would be, more appealing, to the scientific mentality, which, wants to, stay clear of moral, ethical, and, the resultant, political, kinds of issues, that might come up. But still, I think, it is kind of relegating the interactive relational state to a, second class, kind of, status. You could at least, look at the interactive relational state, and you don't have to call it and intermediate states on the way, you know, to the enlightened, you know, mystical state. I think the emphasis, on the mystical unitive state is kind of, hidden influence of the East, religious mentality, which, you know, has infused, you know, the psychedelic, you know, mindset in the West. And so another, possible influence of, you know, my work, you know, within the scientific perspective is the whole, you know, field of, you know, how spiritual experiences, you know, take place. So the current, you know, model, you know, proposes, you know, that the brain, you know, generates the impression of a spiritual experience or of communicating with God. It is a reflex of the brain in response to, you know, certain stimuli like drugs or meditation or prayer. Right. And, you know, that's what I call the bottom-up, you know, model. You know, so I am, you know, proposing, you know, the model that I refer to as a, you know, top-down model, you know, which, you know, can incorporate, you know, brain physiology, brain imaging studies, you know, psychopharmacology, you know, but instead of, you know, proposing, you know, that the brain is, you know, generating these experiences, you know, my model is, you know, kind of countering that by suggesting that the brain is the agency through which God communicates with us. And the brain is, you know, so designed for that communication to take place. You know, so that's kind of a top-down model. And, you know, one isn't meant to exclude the other, but I think, you know, they're kind of intended to, you know, bring a theistic, you know, religious, you know, perspective on spiritual, the study of spiritual experiences. And the spiritual experiences are great, you know, meeting point, you know, for science and, and religion, you know, because it's of interest, you know, to both fields, and you can understand the experience from both a religious and a, you know, scientific point of view. And if you could, you know, merge them in, you know, somehow and be able to enlarge the discussion to include, you know, both perspectives, I think, you know, that both perspectives are going to be rich or, you know, richer as a result.
Okay.
You know, in the more, you know, practical, you know, sense, I think, you know, to look at the Hebrew Bible, you know, like as a possible, you know, key to interpret the experiences that people have in their psychedelic experiences, you know, can be useful. It's a Western tool. It incorporates, you know, Western ideas, you know, Western words and concepts, you know, names, you know, narratives, ideas, all those things, as opposed to a shamanic or an Eastern religious one. You know, so, you know, culturally, it's a lot more, you know, resonant, you know, with the Western mind, and can, I think, you know, provide a toolbox, which is currently missing from any, you know, discussion of using these, you know, compounds for their spiritual purposes. You know, like, you know, for example, if you learn about the different, you know, names of God, for example, you would be able to recognize, you know, those, you know, different characteristics of God in a, you know, psychedelic state. And if you weren't, you know, kind of cognizant of those, you know, differentiations, you might be baffled, you know, by different manifestations, or you might not even recognize them. You know, some of the, you know, recommendations for interacting with angels, which, which occurs in the Hebrew Bible, could also be utilized in the psychedelic state. You could ask questions. You can introduce yourself in a certain way. You could beg their pardon. You can ask good questions. You can understand what they're saying to you in a, you know, manner that might not be otherwise available, you know, to you if you weren't familiar, you know, with comparable, you know, phenomenology in the text.
Okay. Have you seen much backlash from including a religious element into this work?
Some. When the new book, you know, first came out in September, it, you know, sold like hotcakes. But I think when the word, you know, got out, you know, that I was emphasizing the Hebrew Bible to the extent I was, I think interest flagged among those with a primarily psychedelic worldview influenced by, you know, shamanism or by Eastern religions. But as time is going on, I think it's beginning to attract a more, you know, serious readership, you know, people that can kind of, you know, hang in there with me as I explain, you know, the reasons, you know, for my turning, you know, from the science, from, you know, Buddhism, you know, from shamanism, you know, to the world of the Hebrew Bible. You know, it is some heavy lifting. It requires dealing with certain things which a lot of educated, secular, you know, Westerners have a, you know, visceral, you know, kind of reaction against, you know, like the idea of God and, you know, the idea of the Bible as a spiritual text. And I expend a great amount of energy in the early part of the book explaining how I got from point A to point B. And the, you know, possible, you know, kind of stumbling blocks and, you know, how I was able to overcome them. You know, so, you know, still, it can be a, you know, tough nut to crack for, you know, for lots of people, you know, without, you know, much, you know, familiarity or, you know, comfort, you know, with the text. You know, it's interesting, you know, like along those lines, I am, you know, getting some, you know, thoughtful and evocative responses, you know, from the Jews out there and the Muslims and the Christians. The Christians, in particular, you know, seem to be interested in the new book. You know, in particular, you know, the evangelical, you know, Protestants out there are, you know, extremely interested in this work. You know, but, you know, the Muslims are interested in it, you know, the Jews are interested in it as well. You know, so it is, you know, beginning, you know, to infiltrate into the Bible reading, you know, segment of the population.
Well, it definitely presents those passages in a very different way that I don't think most people have ever looked at them in that respect. I mean, there's been a lot of interpretations on that. Of course, you know, Ezekiel's wheel has been forever associated with ancient aliens and such, but you make a completely different argument about it, and it makes a lot of sense.
Well, good. You know, it's some slow going through the book, you know, but I think, you know, once I make the comparisons and began to speculate about what those comparisons mean, I think they appear in a pretty good light, you know, like it makes a lot of sense. You know, it's, you know, kind of like, you know, the, you know, key to understanding a lot of these, you know, things is under our nose, you know, like there's the Bible, as opposed, you know, to Buddhism or, you know, the Amazon jungle. But, you know, sometimes, you know, things which are, you know, which are, you know, you know, which are right in front of your face or under your nose are the most, they can be the most elusive.
And you're also not saying that people must convert to Judaism to understand the DMT experience.
No. But I think, you know, you could appreciate what the text has got to offer, and you
yes.
can look into how people have interpreted the text. And one of the, you know, ways of interpreting, you know, the text is, you know, through the lens of, you know, Judaism. You know, like I study text, and that's my practice, and I like it, and I am minding my own business. You know, I am not trying to convert anybody. I don't have a group. You know, it's kind of like an interesting world. It's helped explain a lot of things which I had been, you know, puzzling about, you know, for most of my life. But I don't think that would necessarily translate as a particular kind of lifestyle or declaring an allegiance to any particular group one way or or the other. I believe that the Jewish approach to the Hebrew Bible is the most cogent, but there are certainly other ways of looking at it.
Now, do people still have these prophecy type experiences today, or do we just see the psychedelic type of experience replacing it?
Well, there's if you look at revival meetings and Pentecostals and whatnot, there are clearly altered states which are occurring. Whether that's form of prophecy, is it a form of true or false prophecy? They're being possessed by, but what are they being possessed by? So I think one of the functions of my book will be to begin the sober critical approach to studying the prophetic state. It isn't going to be some sidelight of specific religious groups. It'll be a larger topic for discussion within the scientific and religious communities. So the whole question of is there still prophecy occurring, or like as the rabbis declared 2,000 years ago, it ended. I think the study of the spiritual experience using psychedelic drugs is going to be a great leverage point for a more broad-based, open broad-based and open minded approach to discussing these kinds of states. And the role of DMT is clearly important. It's a compound in our brains and our bodies which produce this experience of complete other worlds, and it's there all the time. It's being metabolized by the brain as brain food in some ways. So any discussion of the prophetic state, I think, needs to include DMT. And if you're going to be experimentally, occasioning the prophetic state, the psychedelic, drugs are going to be so they are going to be playing a role in within any discussion of the phenomenon.
Okay, Luke, any last questions?
Yeah, and you may not know the answer to this, but have you noticed a difference in the response to how your work is received between generations, in terms of the older generation versus my younger generation?
Well, that's an interesting question. The majority of the older generation, mostly, they kind of reminisce. Like about their former experiences in the 60s and the 70s. They like to tell stories. Some of them that are looking at my new book express some gratitude that I'm presenting their older experiences in a different context, and it's made them start to think about the Bible, and also to think about their their older drug experiences in a different light.
Right.
The younger generation, they're more interested in doing their research. They're quite keen on doing psychedelic research. You know, that's always, you know, been the case in their responses to my first DMT book. But, you know, now that, you know, that I've kind of ventured into the more spiritual and you know, religious, you know, worlds, I'm, you know, beginning, you know, to hear, you know, from philosophy grad students and, you know, religious, you know, studies grad students and, you know, some more of, you know, the academic religious, you know, world out there as opposed to the, you know, purely psychedelic, you know, well, you know, psychopharmacology, you know, clientele or, you know, demographic out there.
It's interesting.
All right. Well, the new book is DMT and the Soul of Prophecy. And the original book, of course, is DMT, the Spirit Molecule. You got a documentary out on that as well that came out in between. And we were talking briefly. You have a book that you wrote some stuff for. What was that?
Yeah. So I co-authored, collected, you know, works kind of book called Inner Paths to Outer Space. It more, you know, focuses on the, you know, contact experience. It was the brain, you know, child of a oncology researcher, who's also quite interested in, you know, science fiction. And, he was interested in, you know, getting the word out to the science fiction, you know, reading community. And also his name is Slavik Vojtovich. And I also got Eduardo Luna to participate in the book. So he contacted a Hungarian psychiatrist colleague of his, whose name is Ed Frixa. So the four of us, you know, approached the entity contact experience from a number of, you know, different perspectives. Dr. Luna, you know, from the ayahuasca perspective, Dr. Fresca, from the perspective of, you know, some of the ancient, civilizations out there and even quantum physics, and, Dr. Vojtovich, you know, from the perspective of, you know, the science, you know, from the world of, you know, science fiction, both, you know, books and films.
Okay. And what does the future hold for you?
Well, so as I mentioned earlier, I'm really, you know, fascinated by the character of Abraham. He, you know, lived a prophetic life, you know, kind of, you know, based on, you know, well, you know, based on, you know, communicating with, you know, with God and with God's angels. And he also was a quite keen observer of the natural world, which is, you know, kind of, you know, how he arrived at, you know, God in the first place. And, you know, he was a great teacher. You know, he was a great, you know, social activist. Quite a character. So his life occurred, you know, like out of, you know, the context of any organized religion. He, you know, kind of developed it as he went along, you know, but was inspired and constrained, you know, kind of guided, you know, all the way, you know, like as a result of his prophetic encounters. You know, so I think it would be quite helpful or of, you know, great interest, and it, you know, might not alienate, you know, my readers as much, you know, let's say, if I could, you know, take this material and, you know, fictionalize it in a, you know, compatible, you know, way with, you know, the Western mindset, but include at, you know, the same time a, you know, psychedelic, you know, mentality, at least to the extent that the prophetic and, you know, psychedelic states overlap.
Oh, okay. So is that something already in the works?
Oh, you know, I'm kind of a mad note taker, so I just take notes of every, you know, thing I read, and I've been, you know, kind of scouring the world for books on Abraham, and, you know, there is a lot written. You know, there isn't as much written about Abraham as there is about the prophetic states, so, you know, thankfully, it won't take, you know, 16 years, but after a while, like, I start, you know, taking so many notes, you know, that my brain starts to, like, break. So at that point, like I start to write. So I'm still at the note taking phase, but I feel like I'm kind of closing in on being able to attempt writing about this episode in Abraham's life and another episode in his life. So hopefully within a year I'll start writing and maybe get something out within a couple of years. It would be like a multi volume series because of the complexity of his life, like how long he lived, all of the things he encountered, like Sodom and Gomorrah, and the sacrifice of Isaac,
right,
Sarah, Hagar and Ishmael, all of those are really quite jam, they're extremely jam, packed with information and interpretation. So I think I'll probably be able to recount a couple episodes, per book. So there might be a hand, full of books, that come out over the years.
Huh. All right then.
Yeah, well, and also, there isn't really a good translation of the Hebrew Bible out there. One of the questions that I'm so one of the questions that that I receive every so often is, is there an easy to read translation of the Hebrew Bible out there? And most of them are interpretations, or all of them are interpretations. But everybody's got an axe to grind when they're translating the Hebrew Bible. So I think it would be of value to put out a translation of the text, which is approachable. And the main intent would be to make the text intelligible, as opposed to the main intent being to offer a specific sectarian interpretation of the text.
Right.
Perhaps after complete this Abraham. Once I complete the Abraham, project, I may want to, take a stab at, working on a, friendly translation of the Hebrew Bible.
Nice. All right. Well, I thank you for all this work. I mean, the new book is fantastic and so unique in its structure. Not that the DMT, the spirit molecule, wasn't. You've offered so much to people. And if they haven't read your work, they really need to.
Okay. Well, great. Well, I enjoyed our conversation. And, hopefully, people will start, reading more about DMT in the Bible and thinking about what it all means.
All right, and that includes our talk with Rick Strassman. And next week, I believe we're going to have Steph Young back on, talking about her new book, The Body Collectors, Chronicle of Stolen Souls. And that is going to be quite an interesting talk. The week after, I have Joshua Cutchin on, talking about his new book, A Trojan Feast. And the week after that, we have Mike Cleland and Aaron Gullius back for part 4 of the history of the UFO phenomena. I will also be putting up a midweek podcast, if it's not already up, with Joshua Cutchin, who, as I said, will be our guest in a couple of weeks, as well as Michael Hughes and Summer Snape, as we talk about the quality of evidence in the paranormal and what constitutes evidence and what the lack of evidence at times actually says about the phenomena itself. For that, you'll either have to go to our YouTube page or the website itself, wheredidtheroadgo.com. And remember, if you want to help us out, click on the links for the books when you're buying them on Amazon off of wheredidtheroadgo.com. That helps us out. You can also send us a donation if you're feeling generous. All right, lots of interesting stuff coming up. This is Psyche Corporation to take you out. Here's Worrying World.
Come in. Understand the numbers pouring over your connection to perfection. 5, 8, 3, 10, you have the singing, soaking into our transmission. 21, 34, 55, 89, 144. Whence came this dream that haunts my mind? Behind a curtain, outside of time. Can you hear the knowledge plays, the whirring of the world? Can you hear the knowledge plays, the whirring of the world? Can you hear the knowledge plays, the whirring of the world? Come in, come in, we hear you loud and clear. Beginning a conversion of the signal here. 1597 and counting. Can you?